It's conventional wisdom that it gets harder to make friends as we get older, but why is that? Most of us encounter plenty of people in the course of an average day who may be just as friendly and interesting as the people we bonded with in school. Maybe what's different is the amount of time we invest in our relationships. As adults, work and family commitments often mean we have to schedule time to hang out. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That seems kind of artificial, doesn't it? So often when we want to get together with people, it's around some kind of structured activity rather than just knowing we have an expansive amount of time to simply be together, to spend time with no particular goal beyond enjoying one another's company. But my guest thinks this may be exactly what we need. Sheila Liming is associate professor at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, where she teaches classes on literature, media, and writing. Her book is called Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. Sheila, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me.
You open this book with a charming story of some friends of yours who are such pros at the art of hanging out that I gather they're ready to open the door of their home to anybody who calls on them, up to and possibly including strangers.
Yes. I open with a story talking about some friends of mine who are also former colleagues of mine when I lived in North Dakota previously. And these are colleagues of mine who are quite a bit older than me. They're both in their 70s. And I tell a story about going to visit them on a weekend. I had been to their house many times before, and they would often invite me out. And one of them had, you know, dropped a casual invitation, you know, please come by this weekend, we'd love to see you. And I said, well, I'll be in the area, I'll go ahead and do that. And they said, just call when you're on your way. So my husband and I were in the car and we were on the way to their house. And one of them, the male of the couple, Virgil, picked up the phone and said hello and talked to us. And we said, we're on our way, we'll be there in 30 minutes. And he said, great, I'll get lunch ready. And then at the end of the call, just before we were about to hang up, he said, by the way, who is this? And it was just, it was the most charming moment of him, you know, showing that he was ready to open his doors to us and make lunch for us, no matter who we were. We could have been strangers off the street, which I thought was so cute. Of course, he was very excited to find out that, you know, he actually knew us. But either way.
I mean, this is all the more precious in our culture because we have what the Surgeon General has called an epidemic of loneliness, despite the fact that technology enables us to be more easily connected than ever before. What makes time spent in person with other people so fundamentally different from time on a Zoom session or a phone call or a FaceTime?
Well, in the book, I try to think of it in terms of an altered quality of hanging out or an altered quality of intimacy. And I talk quite a bit about hanging out on the internet because, of course, that is one of the primary ways that we tend to interact with each other. And for a few years there during the COVID pandemic, it was one of the only ways that we had to interact with each other. But I think that when we're talking about hanging out on the internet or through our devices, our phones, our computers, et cetera, we're talking about a different quality of hanging out, and that quality itself can sometimes feel a bit shallower, that we're not necessarily, you know, accessing a more kind of deeper level of seeing someone or being in their presence or being aware that they're there with us and responding to whatever their emotional needs are in the moment, whatever our emotional needs are. As opposed to that on the internet, I think we do it a lot faster. We do it a lot more easily because it makes things so accessible to us, but we tend to do it in shallower ways.
So part of our problem is that we tend to think of time not spent on productive activities, which is usually to say time spent earning money or resting up so we can go back to earning money, as wasted time. Why do we feel like leisure for its own sake is somehow luxurious or decadent?
Yeah, that's exactly one of the questions I was interested in considering as I was writing this book. Thinking about the sort of stigma that is associated with free time when it is spent in a truly sort of free or leisurely capacity, and how that gets attached to waste or to non-productivity or even to just like killing time in a less useful manner. So in thinking about that stigma, I was thinking about why it is that we feel that way. And, you know, part of the reason I think is because we are just very, very busy people in the modern world. Our calendars tend to be just chock full of appointments and meetings and things we have to get to. And of course, many of those are associated with our jobs and our work, but many of them are not. And it starts to feel like everything is just another appointment on the calendar. Therefore, when we have any downtime, we almost get this sense of gnawing guilt that we're like not participating in that race for productivity that we know so well that fills up the rest of our time.
You were in college at the very start of the Facebook era when college students were the only ones invited to join. It took off, of course, like a rocket. But even back in 2005, you and some of your peers recognized there was a difference between Facebook friendships and organic real-world friendships.
Yeah, I think I was in college at a very interesting time in the early 2000s, and it allowed me to kind of reflect on this shift that was going on in our culture and in our society that had to do with technologies like Facebook. And so in one of the opening chapters of the book, I talk about parties as, you know, a form of hanging out. And I talk about how on the way in my college campus in rural Ohio in the early 2000s, how our parties changed as the result of Facebook. And one of the things that I noticed when Facebook came to our campus is that parties started to become more about being seen later on the internet. So you went to a party in order to have your photo taken, in order to get tagged on a party invite or on a thread where people would be talking about it on Facebook later on. And it stopped being about being there in the room with other people and, you know, just enjoying their company, and it became more about performing for this audience that existed somewhere else, somewhere in the future. So in the book, I talk about the difference between, you know, parties as we used to think of them and understand them and how we feel about them now. And I think many of us feel a little bit anxious and fraught about parties for that exact reason.
I've thought about this so many times. I took a class with a friend recently, and I said, well, I'll take photos of you while you're doing the thing. And she said, no, don't worry about it. I don't want any pictures. And I said, okay. And I was able to just enjoy watching her make this craft and watching other people around me in a way that I couldn't if I felt the need to document it in case she wanted to post it later.
Yes, it makes me think of how many years ago I had an art professor who was talking about how when you go on vacation and you forget to bring your camera, it's like your memories are structured differently than they are if you bring your camera, and suddenly your memories only exist through the photos that you take. And now we go everywhere in the world with these little devices that can take photos for us. And you're right, it does alter our thinking. It alters our understanding about how we exist in that moment. And I think sometimes it alters our relationships too.
Yeah, there's that expression now. It's usually a joke, but we say pics or it didn't happen, meaning nothing counts unless there are documented examples of it online.
Yes, and to the point where I think sometimes it feels strange to come away from an interaction and realize that you don't have any photos from it. If you were so invested in that interaction and you come away without any kind of photographic proof of it, it does almost feel like it never happened.
Parties, of course, are supposed to be these ideal opportunities for joy and fellowship and fun. Why is it that they sometimes fill us with anxiety instead?
Well, I think parties happen for many different reasons. They happen, of course, for the obvious reasons, which have to do with celebration, whether we're celebrating holidays or, you know, somebody's birthday or something like that. But parties happen for all kinds of other reasons, too. They happen because somebody feels the need to perform in a certain kind of way. They happen in the context of work. They happen in the context of, you know, different kinds of social arrangements and gatherings. And I think for many people that can lead to a lot of anxiety, a feeling of, well, what exactly is this party about? Why am I asked to be there? And how am I supposed to perform when I'm there? And then you add to that the idea that there's going to be some sort of like evidence that's going to come out of the party. There's going to be photographs that exist somewhere on the internet that show that you were there. And it becomes about having a good time, but also about like performing the act of having a good time to make sure that you look correct in the photos that surface from the event. So I think that makes things very difficult for people. And even though I'm the type of person who loves a party, I totally understand why all those people, why many people don't love parties.
You remind us of something here that I hadn't been aware of. I mean, today the word party, first and foremost, means a, you know, a celebratory gathering. We also have the secondary meaning where we think of it as just a group of people engaged in something together. Tell us a little bit about its original meaning.
Well, I trace the etymology of the word party because I was sort of interested in its roots. And I trace it from its Latin root, a word partitum, that literally meant to divide or to separate something into its constituent parts. So you can see that meaning held onto today in the word like partition, or even words like apart, which are built into the same root that we get party from. And really, what that suggests is that historically the word party was used to designate a kind of division, a place where some people would feel included and other people would be made to know that they were not included. And I think to this day, some feelings along those lines survive with regard to parties, because parties, even though they are about joy and celebration and survival and all that kind of thing, they're also about who's in and who's out. And I think that's another reason that sometimes we can feel a little bit anxious about parties.
Yeah, that's so interesting. There's probably no one who has never felt a little excluded at a party.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, I once threw a party where nobody came, not one person. So I know the downside of parties as well as the upside here, too.
But it's, you know, something that comes up over and over in the book is the importance of risk taking when it comes to hanging out opportunities.
Yeah, that's exactly it. So even though I did once throw a party where nobody came, that didn't stop me from throwing parties, and it wasn't the last one I've ever thrown. But in the book, I do try to talk about how hanging out involves some level of risk. And sometimes I think those risks can feel really, really big, even when they're not. Sometimes in reality, we will find out that those risks are actually pretty minimal or small, but they'll feel big to us. Like entering into a situation where we don't know anyone, or trying to have a conversation with a stranger, or even just, you know, existing in a space where we don't know our way around very well, as opposed to, you know, the space of our home where we feel very familiar and very in control and very comfortable. So in the book, I try to talk about, you know, how hanging out involves taking risks, and it involves entering into these situations that can feel a bit intimidating to us sometimes.
Sheila, when you moved to North Dakota, you noticed something interesting, which was that many of the parties you were invited to were excuses for people to imagine they were no longer living in North Dakota.
Yes. So I moved to North Dakota in 2014 because I got a job teaching at the University of North Dakota. And I had never lived there before, never lived in the Upper Plains, had very little experience with the area. And, you know, moved there like one does, looking to make friends, start my career, get to know my colleagues, etc. And it took a little doing at first, but one thing that I became very interested in was that there was this whole sort of succession of parties or gatherings that would take place there that were meant to give people a way to imagine that they were not in North Dakota. Now, mind you, I grew to really love North Dakota, and there's a lot that I really, really love about the place even still. But it's a place where winter is very, very difficult and very long and very hard and very cold. So a lot of these parties were arranged around the idea of sort of like, you know, being defiant about the winter or forgetting about the winter and finding a way to escape it. So in the chapter of my book where I talk about parties and I talk about what parties are for, I talk about a few parties that I remember going to annually in North Dakota, particularly a Mardi Gras party that some friends of mine used to throw who they used to live in New Orleans and then had moved to North Dakota like me. And this party was very important for us because it would take place in February, which is maybe the most difficult part of the year in a place like North Dakota, where it is just brutally cold every day and it's hard to even leave your house. But then in the midst of this party for one night a year, we would just act like we were in New Orleans, like it was warm outside. We would enjoy tropical beverages. We would hang out, you know, until late at night and have a great time. And it gave you the energy to keep going. It gave you the energy to face the winter for a little bit longer.
Yeah, that particular kind of hanging out also gives us a chance to experiment with different aspects of ourselves, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that idea that, you know, when you're hanging out in those kinds of scenarios, like a party, you're sort of experimenting with different parts of your personality and trying to see how those parts of your personality come out under different circumstances or in the company of different kinds of people.
Hanging out with friends isn't always perfect, but we do broadly know what we can expect. Hanging out with strangers is a whole other level, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Hanging out with strangers, I think, comes under the heading of those risks that I was talking about earlier on, and how hanging out can feel sometimes a little bit risky. So in the book, I talk about hanging out with strangers as a way to sort of confront that feeling of risk and find out what can happen and what can come from it. But it's also, I think, a very sort of important enterprise in, you know, getting to know the people who you share the world with, whether those are people in your community or wherever you happen to be. In the book, I talk about a particular example, a time that I had several years ago hanging out with a bunch of strangers in Scotland. I was traveling and I was by myself, and it was New Year's Eve, and I was waiting to meet up with a friend who was going to come into town a few days later, and I didn't have anything to do, but I didn't want to spend New Year's Eve indoors. So I went out and I just made some friends, and I hung out with those people all night long, and I never saw them again. but I had a wonderful time. And, you know, the lesson here is sort of being like, I think when we put ourselves out there, there are great rewards to be found in what feels like a very sort of risky or anxious making situation.
Yeah, you describe this as making a choice to hang out with the city of Aberdeen itself, which is, I mean, maybe not the world's boldest choice, but I can also imagine someone forgiving you for just staying home alone. You didn't want to do that.
Exactly. I was young at the time. I mean, I was 24 and I was traveling by myself and I didn't know anyone there. But although I was going to be meeting up with my friend a few days later, and, you know, I thought, well, I can stay inside and I can watch TV tonight, or I can go outside and see if I can find someone who wants to talk to me and be my friend for an evening. And it worked. And I think I was just as shocked that it worked as anybody else would have been at the time. But I had a wonderful time and nothing dangerous happened and I ended up the better for it.
You are a musician as well as a writer. So you've had lots of great experiences hanging out, making music. What is it about jamming that gives it such pure potential, maybe as a way of connecting with other people?
Potential is exactly it. I love thinking of jamming under those terms. In the book, I have a chapter that is called Jamming as Hanging Out, where I think about what it is that musicians do when they get together and they play music, not to produce a record and not to even create a performance that somebody else is going to witness and bear audience to. But the jam itself is something that's sort of different from those other two scenarios. You're not trying to make something that you're going to take away from that moment. You're just trying to make something in the moment. So I talk about jamming as a kind of conversation that comes down to listening. You have to listen to what other players are doing. You have to hear, you know, what key they're in and how they're moving through chords and what pace they're setting. And you also have to listen for opportunities to basically join in the conversation yourself, to enter in, to play something, to add to what they've already been contributing, and then also sometimes to pull back and give some space to them. I think of this as a great metaphor for what hanging out itself is, which, you know, so often consists of conversation, of stories, of just kind of gathering with people and then swapping stories back and forth. Musicians do that all the time. They just do it through the language of music itself. And so I think of jamming as a very special way that musicians, you know, communicate with each other and also build something through their relationships.
Yeah, there's no way to do it properly if you're not entirely present in the moment and also open to whatever's about to happen next.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There's a lot of improvisation that is involved. So you have to be willing to sort of both be listening to where things are headed and also be willing to explore and improvise a little bit and take some risks and maybe even make a few mistakes, because what does it matter at the end?
So your chapter about hanging out on TV is surreal, because you don't just mean watching like the cast of Friends hang out on TV. You had a friend with a reality show and you were literally cast to hang out with her in front of cameras. How did all that come about?
Yes, this is a very sort of strange, and you're right, surreal story that actually might have been where I started thinking about hanging out. Was years ago when I was hanging out in the context of my friend and her reality television show. So this happened when I was living in North Dakota. I met a friend there, and I became closer to her and to her husband, and so did my husband, and we kind of, you know, became a crew of sorts that would hang out and, you know, mark various holidays and occasions or just hang out at our local bowling alley. And then my friend, who was already pretty well known as a food blogger at the time, got an opportunity to start a reality television show on the Food Network. And so what this became was that we continued to do all the things that we had already done together as friends, Only now we were starting to do these things for the sake of these TV cameras that were filming us doing them. And it just made me think a lot about the nature of reality television, especially, but also TV in general, and what we see when we see people hanging out on television. I think it's no secret that, many people use television as a kind of company in their life. But what was revealed to me through the process of participating in this show is that one of the things that it gives us sometimes is this feeling of like eavesdropping on somebody else's social life, this feeling of being part of something while we're still feeling a little bit separate by ourselves, in our own living room or something like that. The strange part about the show with my friend was that after a while, it became difficult to tell what the real hanging out was, if we were doing it when we were by ourselves or if we were doing it when we were doing it for the cameras. So it did become a very surreal experience in the end.
Yeah, I imagine you were told to act natural and just do what you would normally do, but it seems like that must be impossible with a bunch of cameras following you around.
That is exactly it. Yeah, and it's strange how actually hard it is to act natural the second someone tells you to, because of course what that prompts is this immediate feeling of panic and introspection, like what's natural, what's normal in this instance. So yes, in many ways we were doing all the things we had already done as friends, getting together, having dinner, hanging out on my friend's farm, but with that added, sense of an audience being there, and of course the cameras that were filming us for the sake of a future audience, it did become different. It became a higher pressure situation, and it did cause a little bit of introspection on my part about what I was doing.
You were also thinking a lot about authenticity, right? This was ostensibly a show about the culture of the Midwest, including the food culture. The show was populated by people who were not really from there. They were packaging their version of authentic Midwest culture for everybody else.
Yes. And that became very interesting to me too, because, like I said, I was a transplant to the Midwest. I moved there when I was living in North Dakota, and I had been very interested in trying to discover what culture was like there, in trying to learn from people around me and see if I could like sort of find my way into that culture myself in an authentic way. And then suddenly I was being asked to perform that culture, which I felt I knew so little about, for the sake of these, television audiences, which itself felt extremely strange as well.
What is the point of hanging out with colleagues? Can that ever feel as real and satisfying as hanging out with our so-called real friends?
Oh, this is a big subject these days, I think, and it continues to get even bigger as we, move more and more towards situations of remote or hybrid working in this country for many people. I know that hanging out with colleagues can sometimes feel like it takes place under duress, under that heading of what some people will call mandatory fun,
Right.
where you feel like you have to hang out with colleagues in order to, do your job or in order to look like you're a team player. There's a sense of pressure that comes along with that. But I also think that hanging out with colleagues and hanging out on the job and interacting with people in the context of our jobs is really important for the sense of connection that we get to the work that we do. And, I think of, for instance, how easy it is for me to ask a colleague that I work with a quick question if I can just stop by their office and talk to them in person, whereas how difficult it is if I have to like email them, set up a time for a Zoom appointment, and then get to the Zoom appointment, then ask them the question that maybe now I've just found a way to answer myself because it took too long to make that to happen. So I'm hanging out at work, even though sometimes it can feel like it's a little bit forced or under duress, I also think it's something that allows us to build deeper connections to the jobs that we do, to the places where we work, to our employers, and to each other, the other people who do the same job as us as well.
So as an academic, Sheila, you've done a lot of hanging out at professional conferences, which, can be opportunities to meet and connect with people who do similar work. In your mind, are these experiences better slotted into the leisure category, or are they still a form of work?
That is a great question. And it's especially a good question when, as an academic or even as someone who just has to periodically travel for conferences of that kind, when you find yourself doing that sort of work, over a weekend or something like that, and you think, okay, well, what am I engaging in right now? Is it leisure? Is it work? Is it some combination of the two? And one of the points that I try to explore in the chapter where I talk about hanging out at conferences is the idea that hanging out itself in a professional context is work. Normally, what we call that work is networking, but you'll notice in that term we still have the word work involved there. It's built into it. And I think what we're trying to do when we're networking or when we're hanging out at conferences and trying to meet new colleagues is we're trying to expand the sphere of our labor or of our work together so that we know more people who are attached to it. So we have a better sense of the industry we're in. In my particular industry, it's also a way to keep learning because once you become a college professor, you are not going to classes anymore. You are now leading the classes. So going to a conference is a way to continue the process of learning so that you have new things to bring back and, build into your own classroom. So I think hanging out in that context is very, very important. I think it's something that looks on the surface to many people like leisure and just like killing time, but I actually think that it is work and it's something that takes a bit of practice in order to get good at as well.
That blurred boundary made me think about the fact that historically, until the Industrial Revolution, people didn't draw a bright line necessarily between work time and personal time.
Yeah. That's true. Before we were, paid wages that were aligned with hourly work, a certain amount of time that we exchanged in order to receive those wages, I think there were a more kind of blurred or mixed understanding of what might count as work and what might count as leisure. And of course, for people who historically have been invested in agriculture and who live on the site of where they do work, they know that that gets blurred all the time, right? Because when you live where you work, it's really easy to find yourself falling into work without even meaning to when it really surrounds you like that.
A minute ago, you mentioned that it takes a little practice to get good at doing the work of conferences, the work of hanging out with professional colleagues. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think back to when I was a graduate student and effectively, an apprentice for the job that I have now as a college professor. And I think of the way that I would attend conferences back then when I felt, much shyer, when I felt more insecure about my own contributions to the discipline, when I often felt like I don't even know how I got to the conference or got accepted. And I would go to those conferences and I would spend a lot of time hiding in my hotel room, either because, I felt like that was a little bit of a rest that I needed, or because I didn't quite know how to begin the work of trying to interact with other people and, sharing with them, what I do and learning from them about what they do. That's something that I started to get better at over time. And one of the ways I got better at it was actually from a pretty disastrous conference experience that I had early on in my own career, where I went to a conference and had some initial terrible experiences and just decided I was going to bounce back from them. I was going to stay at that conference. I was going to meet as many people as I could, and I was going to come away with as many new connections as I possibly could make. And it worked. I just sort of, I went to everything. I went to every panel. I went to every wine and cheese mixer, and I just started talking to people. And some of those people are still my closest colleagues today.
I love this line in the book. You write, "The two poles of solitude are privilege and punishment." Can you talk a little bit about that?
So in talking about hanging out in the book, I of course was interested in exploring, what I see as the opposite of hanging out, which is solitude. And this goes back to, of course, our U.S. Surgeon General's point that there is an epidemic of loneliness in the United States, and that it's something that many of us are very acquainted with these days. So in thinking about solitude, I was thinking about how we achieve solitude, why we seek it, some of us, and also some of us, why we avoid it. So in thinking about privilege and punishment, I was thinking on the one hand about how very wealthy people in American society tend to engineer solitude for themselves by, of course, having large houses that tend to have lots of space around them that mean they don't have to see or interact with their neighbors. They give them a sense of, feeling apart from everyone in a way that they enjoy, that they, want that under their own terms. But on the other hand, I was also thinking about solitude as a way that we punish people in our culture. And, I was thinking first, of course, about the way we punish children, right? We send them to a timeout sometimes when they're being unruly and take them away from everyone else so that they can calm down. But also the way that prison functions as a punishment that is built on expectations about solitude, that you are taken away and you are removed from society because of your crimes against society. And I think what that reveals is that actually we have some pretty mixed feelings about solitude. On the one hand, we're seeking it and we're trying to engineer solitude for ourselves. And on the other hand, we're trying to avoid it and we're using it as a punishment for people who commit crimes.
You have a little list at the very end of the book about rules for hanging out, and number one on that list is taking time. Time seems like something that we all are trained to say we don't have enough of. How do we need to think about it differently in order to invest it in hanging out?
Yeah, well, the subtitle of the book is called The Radical Power of Killing Time. And I think of that statement as somewhat tongue-in-cheek, because, of course, I don't think that time that is spent idly in the context of other people, friends, etc., is time that is wasted or needs to be killed. I think it's very important time. But I think that has to do with the way that we tend to see that kind of leisure time as being something that is wasted or just easily dispensable. And what I'm calling for in the book is recognizing that hanging out and that, you know, spending time working on our relationships with each other, that that is important, that it is important enough for us to make it a priority and to even set time aside in our schedule to make sure that we are able to make that happen.
Sheila Liming is associate professor at Champlain College in Burlington, Vermont, where she teaches classes on literature, media, and writing. Her book is called Hanging Out, The Radical Power of Killing Time. Sheila, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you, Chris. This was great.
Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.